Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the pioneers of forensic science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science or the people wielding it failed. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussion of the science of murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. In my daily life, I'm a medical laboratory scientist. My profession is grounded in the how and why of biological and chemical data. I look at a clinical result and I try to see the human story behind the data. That's kind of how I look at these cases. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how the science has developed to catch and convict the offenders. I'm here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. Think of this as your official invitation to come over to the dark side. Don't worry, we have cookies. And we also have a shared love of hard science, lab techniques, and deep psychological breakdowns. I know I'm not the only one out here who stays up way too late fascinated by the science of murder. So let's find each other, pull up to the bench, look at the data, and learn together. Today we are continuing our discussion of abductions. In part one, we established that a transient second location is a single-use container, an unengineered space meant to hide a rapid crime. But what happens when an offender steps out of that short game entirely? The pivot brings us directly to the opposite end of our taxonomy, the microenvironmental prison. What happens when an offender's goal isn't a single violent climax? What if they aren't driven by a fast, explosive urge to end a life, but rather a slow, relentless fantasy to dominate it? To steal the victim's autonomy piece by piece, day after day, for years on end. Today, we step across the threshold into the off-the-grid universe, where the environment itself becomes the continuous crime. When an abductor chooses long-term confinement, they completely abandon the fast-paced, destructive sprint of the transient killer. They step out of the short game entirely and attempt to run a permanent, off-the-grid simulation of total omnipotence. Behaviorally, the physics of the second location shift instantly. The space is no longer a quiet canyon or a dark stretch of roadside used for a brief, violent event. The space becomes a permanent operational hub. In abduction, the crime is not a transient act occurring inside the environment. The environment itself, the engineered cellar, the boarded bedroom, the hand-dug dirt pit, is the continuous compounding crime. Every second the lock stays engaged, every breath the captive takes inside that perimeter, the crime is actively occurring. To pull off this simulation of godhood, the captor attempts to build a closed universe. They believe that by fortifying doors, soundproofing walls, and cutting off line of sight to the outside world, they have achieved total tactical insulation. The ultimate failure point of the long-term captor is, ironically, time. Time completely destroys the illusion of insulation. The moment a perpetrator locks that door for the long haul, they are forced to step out of the role of a fleeting attacker and assume the role of a full-time prison warden. Suddenly, they are forced to solve relentless, complex problems in structural engineering, acoustics, waste management, caloric supply, and biological resource allocation. They have to keep the biological machine of the victim running without letting the outside world notice the massive footprint that life requires. And that's where the architecture falls apart. You can attempt to hide a corpse, but you cannot hide the continuous biological and thermodynamic demands of the living. By transforming their location into a long-term prison, the captor creates a steady, unerasable stream of operational, financial, and biological footprints. A constant drip of data leaking directly into the grid. And often, supported by every single piece of physical, biological, and spatial evidence generated by their sheer survival, a living witness returns. When a victim survives long-term captivity, their very body becomes a chronological, biological archive of the space. Every trace of metabolic dust, every nutrient deficiency, every layer of atmospheric particulate trapped in their hair or embedded in the soles of their feet acts as a forensic timestamp. The captor believes that by breaking the victim's spirit, they have neutralized them as a threat. They assume that psychological trauma will render the survivor's testimony incoherent or easy to dismiss. What the isolationist fails to understand is that a living survivor does not need to deliver a perfect deposition to tear down that hidden world. The physical reality of the environment corroborates them. When a survivor describes a specific acoustic pattern, the distinct hum of a water heater cycling through a drywall partition, the rhythmic, metallic clanking of a municipal bus passing over a specific sewer grate at 6:15 every morning. They hand investigators a precise spatial and structural map. When their skin shows the severe dermatological impact of decades without ultraviolet radiation, or when blood work reveals chronic specialized organ strain, the laboratory verifies the physical parameters of their prison down to the cubic foot. The perpetrator can manipulate the victim's mind, alter their perception of time, and exert psychological domination inside that room. But they cannot alter the impartial physical laws of the universe. The moment that survivor steps across the threshold back into the outside world, their physical existence becomes the ultimate living piece of transfer evidence. The captor didn't just build a prison, they built a physical mold of their victim's captivity, and the survivor's body is the exact undeniable cast that fits into every single groove of it. Under the cold analytical lens of forensic science, the victim's survival does not just challenge the captor's omnipotence, it utterly dismantles the architecture that created it. When we shift past transient horrors into the reality of long-term captivity, the perpetrator's relationship with the second location changes entirely. We begin our profile of permanent isolationists with Ariel Castro, who transformed his typical two-story Cleveland home at 2207 Seymour Avenue into a highly structured, compartmentalized visual and acoustic vault. Castro's setup represents an intermediate level of architectural modification, relying on standard residential materials, improvisational hardware, and continuous obsessive behavioral control. Castro's engineering focused on visual concealment, acoustic dampening, and physical compartmentalization. From the street, the house appeared ordinary, but inside, every boundary was manipulated. He boarded up windows from the interior, covering the frames with heavy blankets and thick cardboard, before applying mirrored film directly to the glass to reflect light and eliminate any line of sight from neighboring properties. Beyond the sealed windows, the interior layout was deliberately altered into a disorienting maze designed to obstruct fluid movement and visibility. Investigators documented a porch swing intentionally wedged across the central flight of stairs to block rapid movement. Heavy bedspreads hanging as thick acoustic partitions between the kitchen and living areas, and a multi-layered system of curtains concealing the steps leading to the upper bedrooms where the women were held. The doors to those upper bedrooms were aggressively altered to function as secure cells. Castro removed the interior doorknobs entirely, making it physically impossible to open the doors from the inside. He secured each entrance from the hallway using heavy-duty padlocks and sliding bolts. Because boarding up the windows completely cut off natural air circulation and created high humidity, stagnant atmospheric traps, Castro took a drill bit and bored small ventilation holes directly through the wooden bedroom door frames to allow just enough air to exchange to prevent suffocating his captives. To protect this interior prison from external intrusion or unexpected exit, Castro engineered an improvised electronic perimeter. Across the inside of the main front door, investigators documented a series of loud alarm clocks and basic electronic contacts wired directly together. This rigged circuit was designed to trigger a harsh, high decibel acoustic alert if the door was opened even a fraction of an inch while he was sleeping or away. Down in the basement, his containment methods were even more destructive to the physical structure. Castro drilled heavy steel eye bolts directly into the central loaded bearing support pole and overhead wooden joists, wrapping heavy logging chains through them to anchor the victims. These installations crushed the surrounding wood fibers, exposing raw, unsealed lumber that absorbed ambient moisture and ultimately preserved a trace biological material for crime scene technicians decades later. For over 10 years, Castro relied on this claustrophobic system of padlocks, curtain partitions, and acoustic tripwires to maintain his microstate. But because his system was built on continuous obsessive human maintenance, rather than automated structural engineering, it possessed a critical vulnerability: human error. On May 6, 2013, that mechanical operation discipline shattered. Castro stepped out of the house to purchase fast food, making a single fatal oversight in his routine. He locked the outer storm door, but failed to fully engage the heavy-duty padlocks on the interior door, the partition holding Amanda Berry. Recognizing the immediate, unprecedented break in his physical perimeter, Berry did not hesitate. She reached through the narrow gap of the partially unlatched inner door, only to find the exterior storm door securely locked from the outside. Trapped in the small enclosed porch area, she began violently pounding on the lower plastic panel of the storm door and screaming for help. Her screams alerted neighbors, including Charles Ramsey, who ran onto the porch. Realizing the door was locked from the outside and Barry could not squeeze through the frame, Ramsey kicked out the bottom aluminum and plastic panel of the storm door. Amanda Barry crawled through the splintered hole into the daylight, carrying her 6-year-old daughter, born in captivity, and ran to a neighboring house to dial 911. Within minutes, law enforcement breached 2207 Seymour Avenue. The outer alarm system failed to protect Castro because he was not there to respond to it, and his carefully constructed maze of curtains, chains, and padlocks instantly surrendered its contents. The living witnesses stepped across the threshold, and the intermediate fortress collapsed into an active, race-rich crime scene. And while Ariel Castro engineered a compartmentalized, boarded fortress within a standard home, Gary Heidnik's North Marshall Street house in Philadelphia represents a far more primitive, chaotic, and volatile level of long-term captivity. Heidnik possessed a tested genius-level IQ of 148, yet his behavioral execution in the physical world was deeply disorganized, crude, and reactive. He operated not as a methodical planner, but as a murderer and serial offender whose operational discipline was in a state of rapid, continuous systemic collapse. Rather than building an engineered subterranean vault, Heidnik utilized the raw, damp basement of his row house. He took a hand shovel and dug a crude 4-foot-deep pit directly into the soil of the basement floor. Over 4 months between December 1986 and March 1987, Heidnik abducted 6 women: Josefina Rivera, Sandra Lindsay, Lisa Thomas, Deborah Dudley, Jacqueline Askins, and Agnes Adams, forcing them into the subterranean space. His primary method of physical containment was just as improvised as the space itself. To seal the pit, Heidnik threw a single heavy piece of plywood over the opening, weighing it down with plastic trash bags filled with excavated dirt and heavy logs. This crude hatch lacked any structural ceiling or mechanical ventilation. It trapped body heat, humidity, and metabolic waste inside the hole, turning the dirt pit into an oxygen-depleted, high-humidity coffin that severely compromised the physical condition of his captives. The women were kept starving, dehydrated, and entirely naked, subjected to systemic physical abuse, beatings, and torture. For physical restraints, Heidnik bypassed heavy-duty wall anchors or specialized ironwork. Instead, he forced the women into heavy metal shackles linked by long chains, anchoring them directly to a centralized, exposed basement sewer pipe. This fixed anchoring scheme left permanent physical evidence on the plumbing itself. The constant tension, friction, and movement of the heavy chains created deep mechanical scars, localized rust layers where moisture interacted with scraped metal, and distinct tool mark wear facets on the surface of the pipe. When forensic technicians later processed the basement, they mapped those precise physical wear facets to calculate the exact radial limits of each victim's forced movement around the room. To manage the acoustic footprint of his crime, Heidnik had zero structural soundproofing. No acoustic insulation panels, double-walled partitions, or specialized baffles. To mask the screams of his victims, he relied entirely on high-volume auditory masking, blasting a television set or a stereo system at maximum decibels continuously. This acoustic strategy was exceptionally unstable. Unlike structural soundproofing, continuous auditory masking is completely dependent on an uninterrupted municipal power grid and constant human oversight to maintain volume levels. It generated its own ambient nuisance footprint in a densely populated residential neighborhood, drawing attention rather than deflecting it, and highlighting the sheer operational fragility of his setup. Heidnik could not manage the complex thermodynamics, waste logistics, or acoustic demands of the expanding group he held captive. Proving that high intellectual capacity does not translate to structural or operational discipline when constructing a parallel world. That operational failure turned fatal when the biological toll of the basement environment overwhelmed the captives. Sandra Lindsay succumbed to severe starvation, dehydration, and untreated physical trauma, dying while still chained to the sewer pipe. Faced with a dead body inside his operational hub, Heidnik's disorganization escalated into grim disposal maneuvers. He dismembered Lindsay's body in the basement, putting parts of her remains through a food processor and boiling her head in a pot on the stove. Shortly after, during a torturous discipline event where Heidnik flooded the dirt pit with water and touched an energized electrical wire to the metal chains, Deborah Dudley was electrocuted to death. Heidnik, along with a captive he could coerce into assisting him, carried Dudley's body out of the house and dumped it in a remote forest in New Jersey. The system reached its absolute breaking point on March 24th, 1987, needing to recruit more women to replace those who had died and believing he had established psychological control over his first captive, Josefina Rivera. Heidnik took Rivera out of the house in his car to help him lure another victim. Capitalizing on this rare breach in his physical perimeter, Rivera manipulated Heidnik's trust, convincing him to let her briefly step away to visit her family. The second she was clear of his physical reach, she fled directly to a payphone and dialed 911. Philadelphia police responded immediately, taking Heidnik into custody outside a gas station where he was waiting for her. When investigators breached the house at 3520 North Marshall Street, they discovered the three surviving women, Lisa Thomas, Jacqueline Askins, and Agnes Adams, still chained to the pipe in the dark basement, bringing a violent end to Heidnik's chaotic simulation of omnipotence. In sharp contrast to both the improvised chaos of Heidnik and the residential modifications of Castro, Joseph Fritzl represents the absolute peak of organized institutional engineering. Fritzl was an electrical engineer and a licensed building inspector, and he treated his hidden bunker beneath his home in Emstetten, Austria, not as a crude hideout, but as an industrial construction project designed to outlive him. Fritzl did not improvise, nor did he act on impulse. Beginning in the late 1970s, he spent years meticulously drafting, excavating, and reinforcing a subterranean vault beneath his rental apartment complex, completely insulated from the outside world. Over several years, he systematically excavated the heavy dirt and rock beneath his cellar under the guise of expanding his workshop. He poured thick, steel-reinforced concrete walls and ceilings, engineered to bear the immense structural loads of the residential building above while completely deadening all acoustic transmission from the inside. To prevent sound leakage and secure the perimeter, Fritzl designed a complex transit system consisting of 8 successive heavy locked doors that created a physical acoustic baffle. The final entry mechanism was a massive steel-reinforced concrete slab weighing several hundred pounds, mounted on a custom electronic hydraulic slides and counterweights. It was hidden behind a false shelf in his workshop and could only be opened via a secret remote electronic code known exclusively to him. Unlike Castro or Heidnik, who struggled constantly against environmental degradation and waste buildup, Fritzl built a functional micro-apartment. He installed an industrial-grade forced ventilation system with intake and exhaust fans, wired a functional kitchen with appliances, plumbed a full bathroom directly into the municipal sewage grid, effectively hiding the biological waste footprint of human life beneath the floorboards. This clinical long-term engineering was built for a single target, his 18-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. Elizabeth was a deeply troubled teenager who had previously attempted to run away from home to escape Fritzl's long-standing severe physical and sexual abuse. Fritzl exploited this exact history as his primary operational cover. In August 1984, under the pretense of needing help, carrying a heavy door down into his basement workshop, he lured her into the subterranean vault, rendered her unconscious with an ether-soaked rag, and locked her behind the massive concrete door. To insulate his new microstate from law enforcement, Fritzl carefully weaponized Elizabeth's history of running away. Days after her disappearance, he forced her to write a handwritten letter claiming she had joined a cult and warning her family not to look for her. Fritzl handed this letter to the authorities himself, effectively closing the police investigation and framing her long-term missing status as a voluntary flight. Once she was behind the concrete door, Fritzl established total, terrifying psychological dominion over her existence through absolute environmental manipulation. Because the entire bunker's life support infrastructure, including lighting, fresh air intake, power, and food, was tied to his individual inputs, he controlled her reality through his presence or absence. He made it clear that her survival was entirely conditional. Fritzl warned Elizabeth and the children she would later bear that if they ever attempted to tamper with the entry mechanism or attack him, the concrete door was rigged with automatic gas jets or a remote power kill switch that would instantly seal the room and cut off all oxygen, leaving them to suffocate in the dark. Whether this secondary lethal mechanism actually existed or was purely psychological manipulation, it established total submission. If Fritzl suffered a sudden medical emergency outside, slipped on ice, or was arrested for an unrelated crime, The inhabitants of the vault would simply die of slow starvation behind a door that no one else knew existed. Over the next 24 years, the subterranean vault became the site of horrifying, unprecedented biological reality. Elizabeth remained trapped in complete darkness for decades, subjected to continuous sexual assault by her captor, who was simultaneously her own father. Through these assaults, Elizabeth gave birth to 7 children inside the bunker. One child died shortly after birth due to medical neglect and respiratory distress. And Fritzl disposed of the body by incinerating it in a localized wood stove furnace in the basement. Of the surviving 6 children, Fritzl selected 3 to be raised upstairs in his normal household with his wife, Rosemary, claiming to have found them abandoned on his doorstep with notes from Elizabeth. The remaining 3 children were forced to live their entire lives alongside Elizabeth in the subterranean vault, never seeing natural light or the outside world for over 2 decades. Yet, despite his industrial engineering, Fritzl could not bypass the fundamental laws of human biology. Time and developmental health ultimately destroyed his insulation. In April 2008, the closed biological system collapsed when 19-year-old Kirsten, Elizabeth's eldest daughter, who had lived her entire life inside the bunker, suffered a severe, life-threatening renal failure and lost consciousness. Elizabeth pleaded with Fritzl until he finally agreed to move the unconscious girl out of the vault and transport her to the local hospital in Amstetten. Kirsten's sudden arrival at the hospital in critical condition, coupled with her severe physical state, extreme lack of sun exposure, and total absence of medical records, immediately alarmed attending physicians. When doctors issued an urgent plea on local television asking the mother to come forward to provide medical history, Fritzl realized he was losing control of the narrative. On April 26, 2008, Fritzl brought Elizabeth out of the bunker, intending to claim she had finally returned home from her cult. However, hospital staff noted the severe, unnatural psychological dynamic and extreme physical distress of Elizabeth, who refused to let Fritzl out of her sight while speaking to the doctors. Once law enforcement took Elizabeth into a private room and assured her that she and her children would never have to return to her father, the 24-year silence broke. Elizabeth detailed the exact location of the hidden bunker, the secret electronic door, and the decades of captivity. Within hours, police entered the workshop, bypassed the acoustic baffles, and brought the surviving children into the light, completely dismantling the most engineered isolationist vault in forensic history. When we move from the acts of these perpetrators to the physical mechanics of these spaces, under a clinical bench perspective, a stark operational reality emerges. A perpetrator's true criminal capability is not measured by raw intellectual metrics, but by their spatial discipline and thermodynamic management. The transient execution site relies on a violent sprint, a temporary environment consumed by the offender's immediate need to destroy evidence. The microenvironmental prison, though, is a grueling marathon, The captor attempts to maintain a static, off-the-grid universe inside an active, interconnected world. Yet, under the lens of forensic analysis, no enclosed space can ever remain a closed system. Every breath drawn, every kilowatt consumed, every gallon of water flushed, and every door unlatched creates an unavoidable exchange of energy and matter. The captor isn't merely running a prison. They are attempting to suppress a continuous bleeding stream of operational footprints from leaking out into the surrounding municipal grid. The survival of a long-term second location hinges entirely on the perpetrators' operational patience and their ability to suppress anomalies in their daily routine. This operational spectrum stretches from the chilling decades-long patience of Joseph Fritzl down to the chaotic rapid collapse of Gary Heidnik, with Ariel Castro occupying an intermediate space of improvisational control. Joseph Fritzl managed his logistics with clinical, decades-long discipline. Over 24 years, he purchased food, clothing, hygiene products, and medical supplies in tiny incremental volumes. He deliberately varied his retail locations across different towns, never making bulk purchases that would trigger a suspicious consumer profile or alert retail supply chain analytics. Because his subterranean bunker was wired directly into his home's primary electrical and water meters, the extra utility draw was slow, steady, and easily masked under his established profile as an active landlord running heavy tools and laundry equipment in a multi-unit property. Ariel Castro maintained a similarly controlled, yet far more bizarre, financial microeconomy inside his Cleveland home. He kept a significant reserve of cash hidden inside an appliance, which he would throw at his victims following abuse, forcing them to pay him back for any requested personal items or extra food. This localized forced economy allowed him to strictly regulate the flow of physical goods entering the house while keeping his outward personal expenditure perfectly matched to his normal, modest baseline income as a school bus driver. In violent contrast, Gary Heidnik possessed zero operational patience. He abducted six women in a frenzied 5-month span between November 1986 and March 1987. His crude residential infrastructure was instantly overwhelmed by the sudden massive resource demand. Heidnik could not manage the physical waste, the nutritional requirements, or the intense acoustic and psychological chaos of holding multiple captives in a single basement. The rapid accumulation of biological waste and the eventual deaths inside his facility exposed the total failure of his chaotic, reactive approach, proving that high intellectual metrics mean nothing without spatial and structural discipline. To evaluate how these microenvironmental prisons functioned under physical and forensic inspection, we examine their structural choices across four key environmental parameters: excavation, access control, acoustic mitigation, and life support. At the most primitive end of the matrix lies Gary's Heidnik's basement pit. Heidnik relied on a hand-dug dirt hole in a damp residential cellar, His access control was an improvised sheet of plywood weighed down with dirt bags and logs. He offered zero structural ventilation, allowing the pit to fill with water and human waste, and attempted to manage acoustic leakage through the unstable method of blasting a television or stereo at maximum volume to drown out screams. Ariel Castro occupied a middle tier, modifying the existing layout of a standard two-story house. Instead of excavating downward, he converted upper-level bedrooms and basement center poles into retention points. He removed interior doorknobs, secured doors with exterior padlocks, and boarded windows, drilling small ventilation holes through door frames to maintain basic airflow. His waste management relied on plastic buckets emptied infrequently, while his acoustic strategy used heavy blankets and drapery partitions to dampen sound internally. Backed by an improvised electronic perimeter of alarm clocks wired to the front entrance. And then at the absolute peak of institutional engineering stands Joseph Fritzl's subterranean bunker. Fritzl deeply excavated the earth beneath his cellar, pouring reinforced concrete walls to bear structural loads and deaden sound. His access control was a massive steel-enforced concrete door mounted on electronic hydraulic slides, hidden behind a false workshop wall and operated by remote control. Rather than improvising life support, Fritzl engineered a functional micro-apartment complex, complete with active mechanical ventilation fans and an integrated bathroom plumbed directly into the municipal sewer line, effectively hiding the biological waste footprint of a long-term human life beneath the floorboards. The ultimate takeaway of this forensic taxonomy comes down to a fundamental law of spatial analysis. Time and the physical universe always favor the investigation. Whether an offender relies on crude, violent chaos of a hand-dug pit or the meticulous institutional engineering of a subterranean bunker, long-term confinement forces them into an unsustainable trap. They cease being a hidden predator and become an off-the-grid prison warden, forced to operate a concealed life support facility inside a interconnected, heavily monitored world. While a transient killer counts on remote geography and rapid flight to erase a crime scene, the long-term isolationist is trapped by the relentless thermodynamic and biological demands of the living. You can attempt to hide a corpse, but you cannot hide the continuous needs of a living human being. To keep a captive alive over months or decades, the captor must continuously cycle energy, water, and food in while cycling biological waste and physical heat out. As time scales up, human operational discipline inevitably collapses. The captor relies on flawless continuous maintenance, but human error is a statistical guarantee. A single forgotten padlock latch, a reliance on an unmonitored power grid, or an acute medical crisis brought on by decades of confinement will eventually rupture the physical parameter. When that break occurs, the space stops being a vault and becomes a trap. The human body, trapped in a closed environment, does not exist in a vacuum. It leaves behind a stratified biological archive. layers of metabolic dust, hair, moisture transfers, and chemical plumbing footprints that permanently saturate the structural materials of the room. Ultimately, the microenvironmental prison is a temporary operational illusion. The moment that perimeter breaks, whether through a survivor's heroic breach or a fatal medical collapse, the perpetrator's simulation of absolute control completely shatters. The room surrenders its compounding archive of evidence, and the survivor stepping across that threshold hands the laboratory the undeniable chronological blueprint of their captivity. The moment we transition from architectural mechanics to the eventual destruction of these microenvironments, we see the exact point where the criminal hubris collides with the impartial laws of physics and human endurance. These men built what they believed were invincible parallel universes, operating under the delusion that they could maintain total control over both human nature and the physical world indefinitely. Yet in every single case, the center did not hold. Their engineered worlds collapsed not because of a grand tactical failure from the outside, but because their own inflated egos blinded them to a fundamental reality. An isolationist prison is an unstable, dynamic environment that continuously degrades over time. When an offender attempts to run a long-term confinement space, their ego convinces them that they have eliminated all the variables. They believe they have conquered the environment, erased the state's grid, and fully broken the human spirit. In reality, they've simply built a ticking forensic clock. Gary Heidnik's ego led him to believe that his tested genius-level IQ made him immune to basic physical limitations. He viewed his captives not as dynamic biological organisms with a finite limit, but as collectible items to be hoarded in a dirt hole. His hubris convinced him he could continuously expand his group, abducting 6 women in rapid succession, without adjusting his primitive infrastructure. The environment broke him first through death and then through total operational failure. When Sandra Lindsay succumbed to extreme starvation and dehydration, Heidnik was forced to confront the gruesome physical reality of a decomposing body inside his own living quarters. His chaotic attempts to dismember her and dispose of her remains in a residential zone completely shattered whatever illusion of control he maintained. The final rupture came when his ego convinced him that he had achieved total, irreversible psychological domination over Josefina Rivera. Believing his own myth, he brought her into the outside world as an accomplice, completely underestimating her raw, calculated survival instinct. The moment she stepped into a public space, his primitive, overloaded system disintegrated. Rivera reached a payphone, handed the grid coordinates directly to law enforcement, and exposed a basement overflowing with active biological evidence, human remains, and surviving victims still chained to the municipal pipe. Ariel Castro's delusion rested on the belief that he could maintain a dual identity indefinitely, playing the friendly neighborhood musician, school bus driver, and caring family man, while secretly operating a 3-person prison upstairs. His ego demanded total granular control over every aspect of the women's lives, right down to forcing them to pay for basic goods within his bizarre forced microeconomy. Because Castro relied on continuous manual human effort rather than automated structural isolation, his system required 100% operational perfection every single day for over a decade. His ego convinced him that his routine was unbreakable, breeding a lethal complacency. On May 6, 2013, that arrogance caught up with him. Driven by the mundane desire to pick up fast food, his focus slipped. He engaged the outer storm door, but failed to padlock the inner door partition holding Amanda Berry. It was a single, tiny operational lapse, but in a compressed, highly pressurized environment, a fraction of an inch is all the physical universe needs. Amanda Berry seized that break in the perimeter, reached through the gap, and used her voice to bridge the acoustic barrier Castro had spent 10 years building. By the time he returned with his food, his home was surrounded by police, his hidden alarms rendered completely useless, and his multi-layered maze of drapery and padlocks laid bare to the forensic technicians. Joseph Fritzl represented the absolute pinnacle of criminal narcissism. As a licensed building inspector and electrical engineer, he truly believed he had outsmarted both society and nature itself. He built an industrial-grade bunker with hydraulic doors, integrated plumbing, and forced ventilation, convincing himself that he was an absolute god who held the ultimate power of life and death over his daughter and her children. He weaponized the life support systems, threatening to poison the air or seal the vault forever if they ever revolted. And for 24 years, his ego was fed by the complete secrecy of his creation. But Fritzl's fatal miscalculation was assuming he could engineer his way around human biology and genetic health. You can build reinforced concrete walls to block acoustic transition, but you cannot stop the biological degradation caused by decades of dark, high humidity, highly inbred isolation. When 19-year-old Kirsten suffered catastrophic systemic organ failure inside the vault, Fritzl's carefully constructed simulation of godhood slammed directly into medical reality. His narcissism convinced him he could control the narrative even inside a modern hospital. He brought in unconscious Kirsten to the emergency room, expecting medical staff to treat her without asking questions. When doctors publicly demanded the mother come forward to provide a life-saving medical history, the external world began exerting immense pressure on his closed loop. Driven by the arrogant belief that he could once again manipulate everyone, Fritzl brought Elizabeth out of the dark, claiming she had finally returned from her cult. He assumed 24 years of absolute psychological domination would keep her silent in his presence. He was dead wrong. The moment law enforcement separated Elizabeth from her father and offered a guarantee of physical safety, the psychological spell shattered. Her testimony gave police the exact electronic codes to his hydraulic vault, turning his masterpiece of subterranean engineering into the ultimate biological and forensic indictment against him. Gary Heidnik was undone by the sheer unmanageable mess of human mortality and the relentless survival drive of a woman he believed was completely broken. His ego convinced him he could hoard living human beings in a dirt pit without suffering the physical consequences of severe trauma, disease, and death, leaving him entirely unprepared for the biological realities of decomposition and desperate escape shattered in his basement floor. Ariel Castro was undone by the absolute statistical certainty of human error within an obsessive, manually maintained routine, relying on padlocks, drapery, and a daily behavioral vigilance rather than automated engineering. His arrogance fed a fatal complacency. A single forgotten latch on a spring afternoon was all the physical universe required for the perimeter to fail and the acoustic barrier to be destroyed. Joseph Fritzl was undone by the genetic and developmental collapse of a living body that no amount of reinforced concrete, hydraulic steel, or industrial ventilation could preserve. He believed his status as an engineer granted him total dominion over the human condition, only to watch his 24-year illusion crumble when critical renal failure forced a dying 19-year-old girl out of the dark and into a modern emergency room. Ultimately, Joseph Fritzl's system did not collapse because of an external security breach. It collapsed under the weight of his own human contradictions. A purely tactical isolationist would have viewed 19-year-old Kirsten's life-threatening illness as an operational hazard and let her die in the dark to protect the perimeter. Instead, Fritzl suffered a fatal fracture in his own psychopathic compartmentalization. Driven by a bizarre, twisted paternal instinct merged with the total entitlement of a 73-year-old man who believed his authority superseded the state, he attempted to orchestrate her emergency hospital admission. Decades of operational fatigue and unchecked arrogance convinced him he could manage a medical crisis without breaking cover. It proves that the ultimate vulnerability of a long-term captor, no matter how heavily engineered the physical space, no offender can maintain total vigilance against their own aging, exhaustion, and the unpredictable links of their own human psyche. In the end, the physical space betrays the isolationist. The precise moment their ego blinds them to a single variable, the perimeter ruptures, the environment surrenders its vast compounding archive of biological data, and the cold reality of forensic science steps in to dismantle what was only ever a fragile, unsustainable illusion. When we pull back from the individual mechanics of these sites and look at the full continuum, the core thesis becomes undeniable. Abduction is never just a missing persons report or a static event frozen in time. It is a high-stakes, dynamic behavioral process that serves as a primary forensic indicator. It is the initial fracture in the victim's autonomy, a high-risk operational maneuver, and the primary instigator of a massive trace-rich crime scene. By analyzing these cases as an evolving architecture of control rather than isolated tragedies, we see the true nature of the offender's strategy. Whether a perpetrator relies on a violent transient sprint of a remote canyon or attempts to build the permanent subterranean simulation of an isolationist prison, the fundamental motive remains unchanged: the pursuit of total, unchallengeable omnipotence. They seek to construct a parallel, controlled reality where they hold absolute dominion over space, time, and human life. But as Ian Malcolm famously observed, life finds a way. That isn't just a biological philosophy. It's an absolute law of forensic physics. A perpetrator can fortify a perimeter, board up windows, wrap chains around sewer pipes, or pour feet of reinforced concrete, but they cannot suspend the laws of thermodynamics or stop the unyielding drive of human survival. A closed environment is an operational illusion. The living body demands light, air, water, and metabolic exchange. And in making those demands, it continuously forces the crime scene to bleed data outward into the grid. From the dirt packed into severed stumps on the side of Interstate 5 to the acoustic patterns carved into a basement's overhead joists. The physical universe keeps a relentless, impartial ledger. Every operational shortcut, every structural modification, and every biological requirement creates a stream of forensic leaks. And when that perimeter inevitably ruptures, whether through a victim's heroic physical resistance or the gradual systemic failure of the captor's ego, those leaks instantly surrender the keys of the arrest warrant to the laboratory. This spatial and behavioral balance is where forensic science does its most vital work, but the analysis doesn't end on the diagnostic bench. When you look at the physical mechanics, the acoustic strategies, and the structural choices of these environments, where do you see the most critical operational failure point? What are the subtle physical footprints or environmental anomalies in these cases that stand out to you as the ultimate breakdown in the offender's illusion of control? As we wrap up today's look into abduction as both a method and mode of crime, we return to the most basic forensic principle. Because the perpetrator is forced to interact with the outside world to sustain their microstate, they eventually create a link between themselves and the evidence. Everything leaves a trace. Next week, we're pivoting to a trace of a different kind, a trace of poison. We will be continuing our series on poisonings by examining organophosphates, the overstimulators of the biochemical world. We'll learn how these chemical agents force the body to betray itself and why these organic markers are often the trickiest to find in the laboratory. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue analyzing these cases along with me. And if you found today's deep dive into environmental trace evidence fascinating, please take a moment to review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred platform. Reviews are the lifeblood of an independent show. They help other science-minded true crime fans find our community. I highly encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to come learn along with us. I always want to hear your analytical breakdowns of these cases or any future topics you want to see dissected on the bench. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon at Science of Murder, or reach out directly via email at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. Stay curious, stay scientific, and I'll see you in the next episode.